Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. I have Andrew Lam back on the podcast with me. Thank you so much for coming and speaking with me today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
This idea of what April 30 means to us, I think you and I share a lot of this sort of living in so many different worlds with this idea of April 30. I think on the one hand, we have deep and strong connections and ties to Vietnam, present day Vietnam, and you and I both have similar backgrounds with our fathers in the South Vietnamese army. And I know that not everybody around the world, not every Vietnamese person shares the confusion. Some are black and white. Some are,
right.
Some just don't care. It's yeah. Not even black and white. It's just like a void of any meaning as they live their lives. I want to start by asking, what does April 30 mean to you?
Yeah, so it sounds like an easy answer, but it isn't, because it's been 50 years and my feelings about that date changes with time.
With time.
1975, April 30th, I was 11 years old and I was in a refugee camp called Guam because we have been deposited it there a day before. I was lost. Everyone was walking around like zombies because we had no idea what's going to happen to us. America wasn't willing to accept refugees at that point. And then on top of it, the news on the radio announced the fall of Saigon. And so that particular date, since I'm old enough to remember it very clearly, was terrifying because, you know, you feel this hole in your stomach on that particular date, if I recall it, because you're in no man's land. You're completely displaced. You have no home to go back to, and you have no destination unless America opened its doors. And so the weeping in that Guam camp was a collective weeping. You know, we left people behind. My father was still back there. We didn't know what happened to him. Relatives and friends who may have been stuck. And we know what could happen to those left behind because we've seen the results of 1968 in Tet Offensive in Hue, where they bury thousands of people alive. And so the fear was that the revenge will be swift and, bloody. And you live with that uncertainty, you know. So that was the actual date of 1975, before it becomes Ngày Quốc Hận, you know. I actually experienced the moment of a lost country, right? And it broke my heart, although I wouldn't know it. I don't think I knew that until much later on, but I was completely shattered. 1976, I remember, because by then we moved to San Francisco and there were a handful of Vietnamese living there and in the area. And we were protesting. I was wearing a white headband like everyone else, like để tang, you know, like we're mourning, but not for a relative so much as mourning the loss of country. And so we stood there and we say, Đã đảo Cộng sản, we give Vietnam back to us and that sort of thing. You know, we stood outside of City Hall. I'm not sure what City Hall can do, but That's what we did. And, you know, there was a gathering where people were singing songs, you know, and the same thing the next year. And there were songs like, Mẹ Việt Nam ơi, chúng con vẫn còn đây, you know. So I would speak, I can only speak from that memory, but that there was a moment where my feelings were not completely off with those of the collective, which is that we were mourning, we were in shock. We still want our homeland back, knowing that we cannot have it. And so we live with this, you know, brevity, you know, of loss. But then my life changed. You know, I became American. I integrated in American life probably much faster than anyone else in my family because I was the youngest. I changed my name. And then over time, the date become less heavy, even though it still carried all that burden of memories. You know, and within my family, my father carried a wound deeply because his guilt is very hard to talk about because it's so profound. He left, but he felt as if he had abandoned his comrades in arms. Not that he could do anything if he had stayed, except for going to jail with them. But the fact that he left and they stay left him wounded, you know, in psychically. And though he remade himself in America, you know, his night talks was always about Vietnam, about the battles they fought, the people who died, you know, and the people who lived and the wounds that he saw and so on. So I live with that war. You know, I don't think it has to do with April 30th so much as every night that war came back in some form or another. So I think in some ways, I wrote about it in Perfume Dreams. That's why I wrote it. It's because, you know, this Americanized kid trying to make it in America as like a newly made person, but he carried a heavy burden of that war, you know? And how does anyone who carry that memories, you know, become an American while the sadness and the grief and the tragedy of our lives are not really expressed in American narratives, you know? We're just like side actors or background actors, you know, in that story. And so I think that's why I started writing, really. But in Perfume Dreams, my first book, I talk about the first time I came back and then I was confronted with that date, you know, because I've came back as a journalist for a news service, you know, writing for a wire service that was on AP. And so I was assigned, you know, after covering Hong Kong, Cambodia, suddenly my boss said, go back to your home country and write about the thaw of the Cold War. You know, this is 1991. And I had to fly into Vietnam and, you know, naively at 20-something, 26, 27, you know, I gave the guy my passport. And he said, when did you leave Vietnam? And I say, 2 days, Hai ngày trước khi mất nước, 2 days before National Loss Day. And he was a young man, you know, and he has this look on his face in Hanoi of all places. He's like, what's up, like, mất nước hồi nào? When did we lose the country? And I thought about it like, you didn't lose the country. I did, you know. And so then I'm and he said I muốn nói là I said 28 tháng 4 1975, you know, 28th of April, because that's when I left. And he said, do you mean ngày giải phóng, you know, National Liberation Day? And I thought, wow, you know. And I started kind of, you know, I mean, I kind of started giggling because I thought the irony was so thick, you know, and because I was like, wow, the returning Vietnamese American and the Vietnamese who speak the same language at this moment, but not really the same language, you know what I mean? Because by then we had carried two different streams of history, you know. His is like this propaganda version of like, oh, Giải phóng miền Nam or something, right? And mine was like, oh my God, we lost that country. That day was the date we lost our country. And I say to him that I say, you're probably right. It's probably a liberation day. But in my mind, I wasn't thinking liberation for Vietnamese. I was thinking that liberation in the sense that I've grown, I've changed, I become cosmopolitan by then. I was become more worldly, and that day doesn't own me the way it used to, and that I've self-liberated from the hatred. You know, I have gone into Vietnam with a kind of objective mind just to see what's happening there without passing too much personal bias in judgment. So I feel like, yeah, I'm kind of liberating myself going back because I want to confront that past. I want to write about it in a way that makes sense and balance, you know, which is what I'm taught to do as a journalist. So I thought the self-liberating day is also an important thing, you know, for me on that day.
You know, as a journalist, as a writer, a thinker, somebody who ponders a lot about the experience of the Vietnamese diaspora,
yeah.
I look to you and your writing, and it's so cynical sometimes, and it's so light, but it's so deep, and it's so antagonistic in all directions. And I find a lot of joy in the freedom that you have attained. And you just said it. And I am trying to find the compassion, to have compassion and sympathy for everybody. But it is so damn confusing sometimes because on one end, I want to respect and I want to love and I want to sympathize with the loss. And I want to understand the people that came when they were 12, 13, 11 years old to America, and they had fathers locked up in camps.
Yeah.
And I didn't go through that. I was born in the United States.
Yeah.
And I've had a few dinner party explosions and with a little alcohol and, you know, things have not gone well. And I feel like I'm atoning for those sins now because of my lack of kindness to the previous generation, your generation, my parents' generation. And we've talked about forgiveness and finding that forgiveness. But the hard question is, do you think the other side forgives us?
Yeah, well, it's complicated because forgiveness is not something that is done collectively. I think it has to be done on the individual basis. You don't really come to forgiving until you go through some spiritual phase of your life, you know, and that's not something that you can force upon the people. I think individually there are still bitterness on all sides. I mean, how can you not, right? But I think if they don't forgive, the reality is it's been 50 years and they forget. Meaning that, for instance, in Vietnam, the population more than tripled since I left that country in 1975. The average age is probably 35, you know, which is born 15 years after the war. And so if you talk about forgive, it's more like forget, collectively speaking, because I have gone back to Vietnam since 25 years ago Every time it's a 25th or 30th anniversary, I'm doing something in Vietnam back then. And I had gone in once with an American journalist. And basically, she just asked me to translate for her when we talked to a group of young people. And her first question was, what do you think of that war? Right? And a young man just sort of looked at her and say, which war? Because if you didn't go through war, Vietnam War or French War or, you know, war in Japanese occupation, a war with China or a war in Cambodia, all of that is historical pages, you know. It's not something that is of raw memory. So we in America only look at that war as a singular war, you know. But in Vietnam, they had gone through 5-6 wars in the last 120, 30 years. And so for Vietnamese now, it's just another page in the history book, you know? And I think that's something we have to think about too, is that for those who carry the memory, it's very hard to work through it, you know? But for those who were born after, it's almost like very hard to understand which is the curse of being human, is that you tend to repeat what you don't understand.
Both of our fathers and many of our friends' fathers were in seat of power and positions.
Yeah.
Control. Great lives before 1975, April 30. And arguably, we are the children of privilege, massive privilege. And we've enjoyed the last 50 years here in America.
Yeah.
And abroad. And we've built lives. And we have arguably have had better lives if we were to stay in Vietnam.
Yep.
Life has turned out too bad for us. So I think for me, just sort of playing with all of the sort of these factors, yeah, you know, and understanding like forgiveness and moving on. And it's like, wow, we not only did we have the really fat end of the stick before the war, that we had the pleasures, we had the lifestyle. I didn't. I was born in the United States shortly after the war. So, but everybody, you know, on our quote unquote on our side, lived through great times in the 60s and 70s. You know, albeit the war and a lot of losses. But then when we got to America, we, you know, had nothing in our pockets but the opportunity to rebuild these lives has allowed us to really prosper.
Yeah.
What
I think the fact that so many have done well, especially that first wave that I know, because they, you know, in many ways, the first wave were privileged in many different ways. Besides, for me, I didn't even take a boat, right? I just flew over. But that I went from sixth grade to seventh grade without any, you know, interruption in the middle. Whereas like some people had to, you know, wait in refugee camp for years for that sort of thing. So then, you know, their integration into America was very fast and successful for many, you know. And I think in some way, when we talk about forgiveness, I think the fact that we have ascended from our initial refugee status of having nothing and wearing donated clothes that first year to, you know, going to Berkeley and Stanford and that sort of thing, is that it does dampen us, the blows. You know, it dampened the pains and of loss and so on, even though some people would swear of never returning to Vietnam. But the very least what America have afforded us is this idea that, well, we found another country. We have taken roots elsewhere and we become a different kind of people. And that really heals some of the old wounds, you know?
Mostly all the episodes that I do are mostly very personal, but this one is really damn personal. This episode, because, you know, we're landing on the day of 4:30 and, you know, I think that in my life, I've pissed a lot of people off with this privilege, this entitlement of, you know, not knowing what, you know, my older brothers that are like 14, 15 years older than I, they had to live through the camp, you know, their fathers going to camp and being very insensitive to the experience of the previous generation. And I feel guilty because, you know, I've gotten into a lot of heated battles with this, and I feel very sorry for the way I've carried myself, I think, in the past year. But there's this anger that boils inside of me when I think of like the Vietnamese people all over the world as family. We are all family. And I can't, sometimes I can't approach the nuances the way I should. And it's a huge block for me. And I wanted to ask you, as somebody who I think is fairly fluid in the way you think about polarity and the way you think about different sides and, you know, just, yeah, I read your writing and I'm so entertained by the way you write about sexual orientation and, you know, experience in all sorts of polarizing situations that you can make fun and make light of these things. What gives you that? Because I want to learn that, and I want to apply it to the way I think.
Wow, that's complicated. I deal with very sad and tragic things in my life, but I think I bring my personality to bear. And if anyone who knows me is that I am, for the most part, very joyful. I find there is humor in all things, you know, even the saddest. And so I come from a point of view of not passing judgment so much as observing the follies of being human, you know, which is kind of like a Buddhist way of approaching things, you know. But I don't claim to dismiss people. I hear them. I acknowledge them. I just know that I'm not in that emotional life that they have. That's why, you know, when I was growing up, I was overwhelmed by the sadness of my parents, for instance. And I had to figure a way out of that morass because there is a way in which that tragedy can be inherited without knowing, right? And in some way, because they cannot solve their sadness and they cannot solve their grief, they live with the anger. But what they don't understand is that they impose it on the second generation without knowing. You know,
that's the rebellion that I'm feeling. That exactly is the rebelliousness that I'm feeling.
Yeah, you feel like if you love them, then you're supposed to align with that particular emotion, you know, need for revenge or need to jiatou or yeng keng tei nou Vietnam or some, you know, all that narrative. And being older, I can tell you that pressure was very heavy on my shoulders because my dad said, when you grow up, you need to yeng teng de yai cu Việt Miền Nam, or something along that line. And I'm thinking, but I'm American and I'm not in the army. I'm not, you know, taking an army back to, this is like a fantasy, you know what I mean? To come back and liberate Vietnam like again, I guess. And I just thought, no, that's not who I am, you know? And so I understand where he's come from. You know, I know the sadness and I write about his sadness and I acknowledge it, but I refuse to let that sadness own me. I process them through me and I say, yeah, that's where it ends because I will not carry your grief through me. You know, I will acknowledge it. I will honor it, but I will not let it rule my life, you know? And so, writing has been a great relief, you know, because it allowed me a kind of framework to talk about those things. You know, what does it mean to be my father's son who was a general in that war, who fought, you know, many battles and so on and carried that wound and that memory? You know, all those things I worked through my writing. And I can tell you that once you work through that writing and it makes sense to you, is that you're not exactly through with that history, but you manage to own that history in a way that it doesn't own you. You know what I mean? You give meanings to it and you give a kind of catharsis to it and that you say, okay, that's what it is. And now this is who I am, you know? So then there's a way in which where you are self-liberated, you know, from that war, if you work through all those emotions and all those acknowledgments.
And the crazy thing is, your life is processing being the son of a general. The way I had to have processed this is the aftermath of having this Asian face in American society post-war, 10 years later, 15 years, dealing with the taunts, being in the military, U.S. Marines, and dealing with the racism of being Vietnamese, you know, the drill sergeants calling you names and dealing with the, you know, the white superiority within the military ranks and having this confusion and dealing with the identity of being a Vietnamese American. Wait, but we're on the right side of the war. Why am I getting made fun of when I was the son of, you know, people who were in the CIA and, you know, Phoenix programs and we fought on the same side. Why am I getting made fun of? And I think that that burden is a different, now it's becoming a different narrative. And you're right. You know, I write too. I write to process, and I talk on podcasts to process these weird feelings. And I imagine all of the people that are of my generation, born here in America, who lived in the Midwest or somewhere in the Northeast, completely removed the Vietnamese culture, and they are now part of just white mainstream, and they're like, who cares about this stuff? Like, it doesn't affect me, but it does, because it's, you know, I see cousins in South Carolina, when I'm with them, their white friends make fun of them, and they don't realize that they're being made fun of. I think I'm looking at it going, this is emotionally exhausting for me, but it does not, it's like, it just falls right off their head, and it's like there's no impact on their being. So it's just a weird place to constantly be thinking, and it's emotionally exhausting to be thinking about this stuff.
So in my brings back this memory of if you have a chance, read the story of this. I forgot. I think this owl is full of noises. It's about this this student at Berkeley, you know, who has this idea that he's going to be a doctor. He's in biochem. He's dating a white girl. Everything was perfect. You know, he's getting A's in biochemistry, you know, cheated a little, but, you know, and so life was good, you know. And then this is why I'm fascinated with short stories, because there is, everything seems to be good until there is an eruption of something. And in his case, he was on the street and he saw a homeless man who said he's a Vietnam vet, and they had an argument, and the guy took out a cigarette case and he say, "Watch out." And then he takes out the case, he opens it, and there's an ear. And this kid is completely shocked, right? Because the guy say, you know, I, you know, cut off this ear of a gook, you know, so I'm not as scared of you, that kind of thing, right? So later on, that ear came back in the story. But what I'm saying is that sometimes you think your life is good and that that history has nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
And then it shows up in your face, right? And you don't know how to process it, because you never process it because you think you're good, right? Until you're not. You know, and I find that really fascinating, because sometimes history does erupt, you know, and then how do you process those things? That's the juncture between past and present that I'm finding really fascinating in fiction.
And I found that I read stories from the edge of the sea, and the short stories in it are like miniature episodes that you confront everything. You know, it's not just about the Vietnamese culture, but it's about, you know, lusting after somebody at the Goog, and yeah. The Guggenheim. So that was my favorite one. How long did it take for you to put all these short stories together? And, you know, I think some of them are purely fiction. They doesn't seem to really reflect sort of a autobiographical nature, but some of them are just like sort of like outside experiences of other people that you've written in the first person, or, you know, or
I fiction has to have some truth. In fact, the truest fiction makes people feel like, oh my god, this feels so real, right? Some of the best compliments I have from my previous book, Birds of Paradise Lost, with some graduate student in creative writing, came up and say, "I didn't want that short story to end. I want to take him to lunch." I said, "You know, he's a fictional character." But I think the first rule of fiction is you write a well-rounded character. You have to create someone that is believable enough that you feel like, yeah, that person could be real in real life, right? And sometimes it is borrowed. Sometimes it is fragments of myself, right? But it's not biographically correct, you know, it's just borrowed from fragments, you know. That's why it's called fiction. But as long as I'm going after some existential truth, that is dramatized by my characters, then I feel like I'm doing the work that I wanted to do. You know?
Yeah.
But go ahead.
I suggest everybody picking up this if you need an introduction to Andrew Lam, because it shows such a vast array of a range of your writing, and it's just really snappy and it's just witty and I really enjoyed it. And if you need an introduction to your writing, I mean, I think this is such a beautiful starting place, and you can just read one story a night. It's very very fast, and it was hard to put down the book. It's just fascinating. Where can people pick it up? Where can people buy it?
Well, it's on Amazon, but it's also Red Hen Books also sell it on their website. These days, it's hard to say which bookstore, because I don't know if there are any bookstores left. But you can also ask your bookstore to order, and they will. Just ask Andrew Lam some stories from the edge of the sea, and they will.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I really love it. Now, well, I want to switch, and we can come back to it too throughout this podcast. But I want to talk about like the juxtaposition between what we're seeing online in Vietnam right now today, mm-hmm. and what we're seeing or lack of seeing, we're not seeing in the Southern Cal. I don't know in NorCal what it's like, but in SoCal, there's no really big events that are like, you know, you would think that there's big events for April 30, right?
Yeah. But like, we're not big anymore. They're kind of like town hall kind of situation. Mm-hmm. I actually did a thing 2 days ago at an auditorium in San Jose for like 300-400 people. And we had, dignitaries come and, you know, mayors and, you know, congresswomen and so on. But basically commemorate that day. But I don't think that intensity is there compared to those first few years when I talk about wearing white hairbands and, you know, that I sang back then. Because I think, for one thing, the fervor or the hatred that's carried by a previous generation is sort of fading, you know. I'm sure there's still a lot of unfinished business, but for the most part, I think it's much calmer now dealing with that date than before. And in Vietnam, it's actually not as big as it would have been had the U.S. not imposed the tariff on Vietnam, because now Vietnam is tiptoeing from celebrating that date for fear that it will upset the U.S. government. And because in the past they said that, we defeated American imperialism,
yeah.
and that sort of thing. And so now they're more careful with the language. You know, I think they emphasize the liberation more than they work me part, you know, because they work me is still taxing your ass.
There's still 10. Like over 10,000 soldiers marching with like thousands of drones that are like painting pictures of Ho Chi Minh and, you know, all of these things.
It's normal for a dictatorship to show military might, you know, they all do it. And I think the U.S. is going to go that route too. But I think it's just to show that don't tread on us, you know. And I think it's more like we are willing to fight to protect our nation, you know. But it could easily be a message for China, for all we know.
Right. Interesting.
You know what I mean? And you know, I'm not sure you saw the New York Times article where the U.S. State Department tells all its diplomats not to attend any of those mm-hmm. events, right? So it's already in Vietnamese language is yang mak, you know?
Right.
You
right.
better be careful what you say because we're still taxing you. You know what I mean? So I don't think they're celebrating it the way they had wanted
plan to.
A plan to, like a major propaganda move or something. But now it's much more like, oh, let's watch what America has to say, you know, because we're still dealing with their work.
I still don't know if I agree with you about the fervor here in SoCal of the previous generation dying out. I think it's a little bit more, I don't know what the word is, but I think it's a little bit more calculated, I think. And I don't know, my guess, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I might not the, I'm just guessing. Mm. There's so many people doing business with Vietnam now. Yep. There's so many people having, you know, trips that are, you know, a year, every year, once or twice. Some people own land, some people own homes, some people own property.
Be back to retire.
Yeah. There's so many people that are like connected to the homeland. And so like, how can anybody go out in the streets and parade and down to Kong Sang, you know, that spirit is sort of like, you know, it's washed away, or I don't really know.
I don't disagree with that at all. I think, you know, when I was doing my speech 2 days ago, it was really sad in a way to see the old folks who used to wear those military uniforms.
Yeah.
Really old, right? And they're still wearing the uniform, but some are on wheelchairs, you know, and some are like barely able to walk and had to have help. I mean, they're still wearing the uniform, but they are much older, you know? And I think that energy goes out when you're reaching your 70s and 80s. And so it's not as if they don't want to, it's just that energy is fading because old age, right? And there might be still younger generation who carry some resentment, but it's not a collective anger the way it used to be.
Yeah.
And clearly that's the case.
You know, as you're saying that energy dissipates at 70 or 80, I'm like, it's dissipating for me right now, going into my 50s right now. And I'm often wondering, like, what do I talk about once, you know, the 4:30 date has gone, you know, and who am I? What becomes of me as I lose the energy to really talk? And hopefully I do lose the energy to talk about this kind of identity and really focus on like the beauty of the modern Vietnamese. Right. But it's still here. And I'm hoping that. But then what happens? What's next for us?
Right.
We can't keep dwelling on this stuff, can we?
Yeah, so I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs on that date just because it's, you know, how it's how I process it. You know, and this is from A Few Dreams. Sorry, I forgot what I wrote.
A Few Dreams.
Yeah. So April 30th, 1975, defeat or liberation. It was a day of joyous victory, say a retired communist official in Hanoi. We fought and realized Uncle Ho's dream of national independence, that he asked for Marlboro cigarettes and a few precious dollars. Nguyen Nguyen, a real estate salesman in San Jose and former South Vietnamese naval officer, said, "I could never forget the date. So many people died, so much blood. I could never tolerate communism, you know." Mai Hung, a young, smartly dressed Vietnamese businesswoman in Saigon, had another opinion. "Of course it was National Liberation Day," she said, "but it's the South," she whispered, "that liberated the North." Indeed, conservative Uncle Ho has slowly admitted defeat to entrepreneurial and cosmopolitan Miss Saigon. She has taken her meaning from a different uncle, you know, Uncle Sam. The customs man, on the other hand, stamped my passport and say, "In Druf's brother, there are no winners, no losers. You're lucky, brother, you left Vietnam and became an American." April 30th, 1995. In the Berkeley Hills, in a house that gave to the bay, my Vietnamese-American friends and I watched Gone with the Wind for the umpteenth time and looked for the scene of our unrequited romantic longings. Scarlet, teary-eyed with windblown hair, returning to live in forlorn Tara. She's doing something we no longer can. Or rather, we go only to look and sometimes enter the houses where we once lived. But then we take leave. Children of defeat, self-liberating adults, we hugged instead and over a couple of very dry Merlot recounted to each other our own stories of flight.
Beautiful.
That's how it ends.
So for you, is it liberation or is it defeat?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say in the piece, is that there is the historical loss, yeah, but there is a psychological transformation as well for me, which is self-liberating from mourning and being owned by that grief.
I wish most of us can start to adapt this adopt this sort of mentality, because I think it will allow us to exist in all places that are Vietnamese.
Yeah.
It will allow us to love and to forgive.
Yeah.
And just to do the intake of the culture of how beautiful Vietnam is today, despite all of the fighting and despite all the loss that we can now enjoy after 50 years. We should be able to enjoy each other.
Right.
The people in Vietnam, the people in Vietnamese American diaspora, we do have a deep connection to each other.
Right. I think there is transformative powers in a way of seeing, or a way of seeing differently. Because, you know, one time I went to the Cuchi Tunnel. Have you been there?
Yeah.
Where, you know, it was originally very small, but then American veterans came back and they wanted to see, and they have to dig it like three times the size so that 5 Americans can go through it. You know? So it's like Super Size Me Gucci.
Super Size Me Gucci. Gucci, the American version.
Yeah. Gucci 2.0, let's say. And then, what's so fascinating about that trip was that I'm the only Vietnamese, you know. And so then the tour guy was sort of asking me to help with the translation and stuff. And then she's like, oh my God, you know, this is a white guy, like 20 years ago or something. And then she's like, oh my God, you know, Viet Kieu, you know, where do you live? I say, in California. And it's like, oh, I always wanted to go to Disneyland. You know, it's my dream. My friends are inviting me. I'm saving money to come to Disneyland. And I thought, you know, the Vietnam vex who was standing 10 feet away, staring in that hole in the ground, weeping because his friends died waiting for it. And then the Vietnamese lady who was born years after that war, you know, who learns English and loves Americans, you know, couldn't wait to get to Disneyland. So she saw the tunnel as a way to make money so she can go to see Disneyland. You know what I mean? And for me, that is a transformative moment, right? War, peace, you know, memory and the future, you know, all those things are in us. But I don't think, you know, the war should own us in the way that, you know, it used to.
Andrew, let me ask you something about the way you write and the way you think. The story that you just told shows up many times in Stories from the Edge of the Sea in terms of two polarizing ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. But I, as I'm reading all these stories, I was thinking, do these stories happen at the same time that you tell it? Because you're putting them all together at the same time to kind of like compare and contrast views? Or, you know, are they really happening in real time? I mean, it sounds like the Cuchi Tunnel one in Disneyland, that's happening in real time. But how, because a lot of these stories are so, it feels so natural and engineered so well. But I think, yeah, there were several times I'm like, oh my God, Andrew has such a brilliant way of like putting these two, you know, opposite ends together so we can cook them, right? So we can be aware and wake up to the irony of Disneyland and the Cuchi Tunnels and veterans and, you know,
yeah.
How much of this is actually happening in real time, and how much of it has to be engineered to fit narratives?
You know, I'm not sure how my words exactly, but you know, when she said Disneyland, I started giggling because it's like the irony, right? How many people get bombed out because of this thing. And here she is, you know, introducing this wartime contraption. And all she can think of is going to LA and Disneyland. And I thought, that's the story of Vietnam. I mean, that's how weird it is. Like, giải phóng hay là, you know, mất nước, you know. And why do we have to pick any of those things? You know, we can just tell it and live with that complexity, you know?
You know, I hope that you and I can play a game one day. Name that taboo, and it doesn't become taboo anymore. Like, when you talk about Ho Chi Minh as a hero, that's taboo. And, you know, I talked to somebody about that. And, you know, obviously, he's not a hero to, you know, the South Vietnamese government families of ours. And, you know, but I talked to somebody about this, and Tony Bui, the filmmaker, and we recently had a discussion, and he said, yeah, it's a very nuanced conversation because Ho Chi Minh had 11 aliases. Pick yeah. one alias. Pick one period in his life. Ai Quoc was one of the names, which is the love of country. And you could say that that love of country is very different from the Ho Chi Minh that you see all over the city of yeah. Ho Chi Minh City now as a propaganda piece
yeah.
Of a villain of the South Vietnamese government and all of the horrific atrocities that we as a South, we see that as a symbol of hatred of somebody who's really, created a lot of loss in our families. But at the same time, if we are to discuss these taboo, you know, make a game out of these taboo subjects, you know, they'll be gone in a few years or a few decades. You know, these things aren't going to be so taboo anymore. And I wanted to get your thoughts on sort of like the things that have been taboo in our lifetime and, you know, the things that you think that will not be taboo anymore in a few years.
Are you talking about things related to Vietnam or?
Yeah, Vietnam and Vietnamese diaspora.
Yeah, the most taboo thing would be the flag of South Vietnam, right?
Yeah.
It brings up such a primal feeling for so many people, right? And yet the question is, does it really represent anything at this point, right? And that's really taboo-ish to even ask, right? Like, did Jesus exist,
Was Mary a virgin?
Was Mary a virgin? So I didn't know to get too vocal on that. But anyway, people kill each other on that. So it's like there are things that we are supposedly to take as sacred, right? But why is it sacred, right? I'm not sure you remember when we were at the Vala events at Bowers Museum, and someone in the audience, older, but, you know, very eloquent in English, stood up and asked, why did you change your name? You know? And to her, it was a big deal. I think there is a tone of being judgmental in the voice. Is that you should appreciate and love your Vietnamese name, right? And she speaks from the point of view of like she's the holder of truth, you know. You know what I mean? But why does she think she does is the holder of truth? Because you know, if you go back in history in the 1800s, when the Nguyen dynasty came up. A lot of Ho and Zheng, and they changed their name too because they're afraid of prosecution, you know, persecution. And then suddenly I have friends who tell me that their last name was not Nguyen before, five generations ago, because they all switched. So why does she think her Nguyen family's name is so sacred if in fact so many have changed it out of practicality and survival, right? So then the question is, why do people think what they know is absolute truth and sacred? Right? Because everything should be questioned, right? And worked through. And if they are good to you, if they make sense and are workable, then you keep them. And if they don't, yeah.
Where do we draw the line when we question? Because I think that's the hot water that I found myself in, which is it's okay to question. It's okay to talk about certain things that are hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's the way... It's the way we execute these questions that really hurt people.
I hear you. So what you should take is improvisation. Improvisation teaches you yes and yes but, meaning that you don't immediately negate whatever they have to say. You say, yes, I hear you. And that's an interesting point, but have you thought of? Or, yes. And then there's this other point of view, did you know? You know, meaning that people in conversation are very offended and very quickly offended when you say no. Or, you know, I don't agree, right? So there is a way in which you create a space in which their point of view is represented and clearly heard. But then... still challenge in a way that is not like an attack, at least not the way they perceive it to be, you know? So I wasn't kidding about improv. Improv teaches you to pay attention to how people talk. And sometimes people, when they negate, you know, like, I don't like that, or I disagree with all that, you know, then it's very much like a boxing match, right? And people are forced into a position of attack, you know, whereas Ukraine is like, yes, and, you know, it's an interesting way of creating this, you widen the pie, you make it like this space where people is like, well, my opinion is such that, you know what I mean? So think about it. But yeah, that's how it works for my conversation, you know?
Are you happy today with where things are? Do you want to see change? And if you do want to see change in the Vietnamese global community, what are some of the things that you would hope for?
Yeah. Am I happy today? I thought, well, that's a very general question. But I am dissatisfied with the development or the rate of development of our community. I am in awe and in admiration of so many individuals who made incredible strides in, you know, different walks of life, from art to science to, you know, technology to business and so on. But as a community, we haven't evolved a hell of a whole lot. You know, if you think about it, a community that's 50 years in America, that doesn't have a foundation to give awards to its best and brightest, it's already a loss, right? Because it doesn't seem to acknowledge second, third generation and their achievements. You know, say a Vietnamese American Foundation of Little Saigon, whatever, I'm just making that up. Or a grant that will give a scholar power to study Vietnamese history in America, or a grant that give a translation of Vietnamese writers who write in Vietnamese in the U.S., especially the first generation, like our parents' generation. My dad wrote in English, but a lot of his friends wrote their memoirs in Vietnamese. And where's that translation? Because I can tell you that when I give talks at universities, there's a lot of young generation who do scholarship, but they cannot read in Vietnamese. And then they have cross references to, like, you know, generals and soldiers from the North who wrote stuff that got translated because they have funding for that. But like our own people, you know, who's writing end up in little bookstores in Little Saigon that is, you know, only accessible to other Vietnamese reading people, you know. And their children are studying somebody else's work and not their parents. And I think that is something that a community where things that have progressed should be able to do.
I think that that is something that we lack. And I think that having focus on that is a difficult thing. I think because the Vietnamese culture, or Asian culture for that matter, they don't put a heavy emphasis and the arts the way sort of I think the West does right now. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that it's completely not there. I'm just saying that it's not as heavily emphasized. The cultural passing on of stories is not as viewed as, you know, important as money and statuses.
But I'll tell you what, I mean, yes, but if you look at South Korea, you know, South Korea and the rise of Korean arts and movies
entertainment.
And entertainment is not by a fluke, you know, it is intentional. The government itself perceives its cultural products as a soft diplomacy effort around the world. It even pays to build a, you know, K-pop museum, right? So why is that important? Because if you perceive culture is important, right? You create something that say, this is our cultural product. They even pay for the translation of the, you know, soap opera so that it seduced even more non-Korean to get into the themes of their stories. And it's not as if they make so much money from that. The government doesn't, but it gains so much political weight around the world, right? And if you look at the Jewish community in America, which I am the most powerful ethnic group, they have foundations up the gazoo. so that if you're writing about Israel or Israel relationship with the rest of Middle East, you can go to a foundation and most likely, if you're any good, we'll get a big grant to travel and do the research, right? Why is that important? Because it gives a large framework of who we are, you know? I get disappointed every time they celebrate, oh, we name another street in, you know, Little Saigon, you know, we got another flag up, you know? Well, whoop-a-doo-dah, I mean, that's, and then another statue, you know, it's very much like geographically bound pride. It doesn't have a larger context of we live in a larger world and we want to make a statement. You know what I mean?
Andrew, thank you so much for today. We will be catching up hopefully in the next year to find out how much progress we've made after this huge day.
Yeah.
April 30, 1975, the 50-year commemoration. And hopefully there's progress. You know, there will be. There's got to be progress. I mean, we're as a community, we're doing a lot, but I think there's still a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Sure. Let's catch up.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.